Now a look inside the world of high finance on Wall Street and the young people who go into the business.
Our next guest immersed himself in the world of new recruits to financial firms like Goldman Sachs and Citigroup. He found a culture changed by the financial crisis of 2008 and the Great Recession that followed.
Kevin Roos joins us now. He is a business and technology writer for New York Magazine. His new book that we'll be discussing is Young Money: Inside the Hidden World of Wall Street's Post-Crash Recruits. Kevin, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
I want to start out with the why of this book, because it's such an interesting topic, you know, in the wake of the fall of Goldman Sachs and Lehman Brothers and all of that. You decided that you wanted to take a look at that sort of post-crash world and this group of young people that go into it. And I have to say, I was pretty amazed at some of the sheer numbers of people who go into finance who you wouldn't necessarily expect go in that direction.
It's incredible. For many years, Wall Street has been the number one destination for graduates of top Ivy League schools, and sometimes as many as 40 or 45% of graduates from these schools are going on to Wall Street after graduation. So it's an incredible magnet. And I was curious to see who was going into this industry after the crisis, when everyone was everyone was so angry at Wall Street banks, and the recession had thrust many people out of their homes and had dissipated savings, who was still interested in becoming a Wall Street banker? So I decided to follow 8 first and second year junior bankers through 2 or 3 years on the job.
And I want to talk a little bit about how you followed them, because I think that's important. And I don't want to say this is unauthorized, but you had to use, you know, pseudonyms. You had to make up some details to obscure other facts and so forth. But you talked to 8 actual people, but not necessarily on the record.
Correct. I mean, Wall Street is an extremely secretive place, and all of these big banks have rules against talking to the media. So these 8 young people were putting their jobs on the line, in effect, by talking to me. So, yeah, I had to give them anonymity. I had to change certain details so that their coworkers wouldn't recognize them. This was an extremely risky thing for them to do.
Now, the path that these young people were taking is one that leads to lots and lots and lots and lots of money. And I'm wondering, as you set out to start this, did you have a hypothesis about what you were going to find?
I thought it would be sort of a bunch of miniature Gordon Geckos. I mean, people who really had nothing on their minds except for money, people who, you know, knew exactly what they wanted out of Wall Street, which was to make as much money as possible.
And what you found from my reading of the book is different. You found, in the 8 people that you follow, a pretty wide cast of characters. These were people with a wide variety of interests, not necessarily in business, and they all sort of wound up on Wall Street. But as it turns out, a lot of people sort of wind up there. Talk about that process a little bit.
That was one of the most fascinating things, is that it turns out that Wall Street has been an attraction to even college students who don't have an interest in economics or in business. For many years, Wall Street was sort of the default option. If you didn't know what else to do with your life after you went to Harvard or Princeton or Yale, you might well end up on Wall Street, even if you had studied philosophy or art history, because these banks are very, very good at recruiting. They come onto campuses, they make the process very easy, and they say, even if you don't study finance, even if you're not particularly interested in finance, come here, spend 2 years working for us. We'll teach you everything you need to know, and then you can go off and do whatever you're passionate about.
And those 2 years are interesting, because at the end of the 2 years, that's sort of the dividing line there. And we need to talk about those 2 years. What are those 2 years like for those folks who come into this? Why is it so tough? And then what is so important about that 2 year mark? And then what happens on after that?
2 years are essentially, you are essentially an office grunt. I mean, they're called analysts, and basically what that means is that you are putting together PowerPoint presentations, Excel spreadsheets, and you're doing this for sometimes upwards of 100 hours a week. So there's a thing that young bankers talk about called called the banker 9 to 5, which is when you show up for work at 9 a.m. and you don't leave until 5 a.m. the next morning. So it's a 20-hour shift, and that's not irregular. I mean, these people are on call all the time. They are constantly being interrupted in their personal lives. They have no time to enjoy the money that they're making, and it really takes a toll on them. I was shocked by the amount of depression, anxiety, and real misery that manifests among these young people.
And one of the people you talked to might resonate with some of our listeners. Derek from Waupaca wound up going to school in Madison, worked in Chicago for a bit, and then went to the bright lights in New York.
Absolutely. He was one of my favorite people that I met through this book because he really embodied the Wall Street-Main Street divide. I mean, he was from a small town in Wisconsin. He went to a state school. He didn't have the pedigree that a lot of people who end up on Wall Street do. And yet he ended up in New York working in private equity, making upwards of $200,000 a year. And he was really conflicted about what he was doing. He had you know, people back home that he looked up to who sort of asked him, you know, what are you doing on Wall Street? And he wasn't always proud of the answer to that question. So it was really interesting to see these young people go through the process of figuring out who they were and what values they represented.
We're going to continue the discussion in a second. We're talking to Kevin Roos. He is the author of Young Money, Inside the Hidden World of Wall Street's Post-Crash Recruits.
And you can join the show with your questions. And if you've tried to break into the world of high finance, or maybe your son or your daughter has, tell us your story. And should our financial system be in the hands of ambitious 22-year-olds? What does that mean? Call us at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234, or email talk@wpr.org.
This is Central Time. I'm Jean Purcell.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. We continue our conversation now with Kevin Roos, author of Young Money, about the life of fledgling Wall Street recruits.
And you can join in the discussion if you'd like. If you've got a question or a comment about our topic, you can give us a call at 800-642-1234 or email us, talk@wpr.org. Kevin, before the break, we were talking a little bit about Derek from Waupaca, but the interesting thing about these eight people that you follow is that, you know, I had this hypothesis that they would all sort of be the same, but they were eight individuals who wound up taking eight really kind of different journeys in this 2-year period. And I'm not sure that I expected that when I started the book.
I certainly didn't when I started reporting it. I mean, I think I tend to think, like most people, that Wall Street is sort of a cultural monolith, that the depictions that we see in movies like The Wolf of Wall Street are more or less accurate. And I was actually shocked by how untrue those depictions are, how diverse Wall Street can be. And it's not just sort of racially and gender-wise, although there certainly is more of that than I think we typically see. But it's the internal conflict as well. I didn't expect to find young Wall Street people who had doubts and skepticism about their own roles. But I was sort of delighted to find that there was actually a certain amount of dissonance among these people about what they were being asked to do.
Yeah, and I'm trying to remember which person it was. I think maybe it was Samson, the one who kept the diary. And, he started out when it's my first day going to work and it's going to be great, .. And by the end, his diary was like a totally different place.
Right. He was fantasizing about killing himself on the trading floor. I mean, it really, these months on, you know, working, he was working at Goldman Sachs and just the sort of rigmarole of everyday life and the fact that he was sort of conflicted ethically about this work really, really took a toll. So I think, you know, this can best be described by the fact that Samson and his best friend Jeremy, who also worked at Goldman Sachs, started calling the building Azkaban, like the place in Harry Potter where the prison where people's souls are sucked out of their bodies. I mean, it really felt like a soul-crushing experience to them.
And, you know, for a lot of the people in the book, there was that soul-crushing element and the grind that you talk about, you know, the endless work weeks, the strain on relationships, the tactics the companies use to sort of keep people in the building and those sorts of things. You know, that two-year period then has the promise of that third-year offer and then being a millionaire by the time you're, you know, 30 or 35 or whatever. What do the companies do to try to work with some of those guilty feelings, with some of that conflict, to try to get those analysts to make it to that third year?
Well, until recently, they didn't have to do much because the money was so attractive, mm-hmm. and the analysts were willing to put up with the indignities of the job for the hope of making it to the senior level one day. But in the last few years, we've seen sort of a flow of people moving from Wall Street, actually quitting their jobs and moving out of the industry. So there are people now who are leaving Wall Street banks and going to Silicon Valley tech firms like Google and Facebook and small startups out there. And I think this is really unprecedented in the last few decades. Wall Street has always managed to keep the people that it wants, but that's no longer the case. People have more options now, and they're increasingly exercising them.
And, you know, one of the other things that was interesting in the book, that promise we talk about that big Wall Street career and becoming one of the big players in the world of high finance, when you get there in your 30s, 40s, and 50s, allegedly, you know, something else happens to you. But then you went to this dinner, this Kappa Beta Phi dinner that you attended undercover, I might add. Tell the audience about that, because that was very instructive for me and for what these analysts have the possibility of turning into if they stick around long enough.
Well, Kappa Beta Phi is a secret Wall Street society made up of CEOs and executives from most of the major financial institutions. It was started in the 1920s. It's still around today. And every year they have their annual induction ceremony where they bring in new members. So I snuck into this induction ceremony. I was the first reporter to ever see the whole thing. And I watched as they not only humiliated the new members by making them dress up in drag and do sort of musical numbers and comedy skits, but they also, these skits tended to be pretty offensive. I mean, they were not only sexist, homophobic jokes being made, but there were a number of skits that actually mocked the people who had been protesting Wall Street. There were things mocking the Occupy movement and mocking the bailouts. There was a song that they sang called Bailout King that was set to the tune of ABBA's Dancing Queen. So really offensive stuff. And what surprised me is that, you know, when I saw this, obviously, and then eventually out, you know, got caught and sort of thrust out of the building, I told the young people about what I'd seen, the young people that I was following, and they thought it was as ridiculous as I did. So I think, you know, it was a little heartening to hear that there's sort of a generation gap in finance as well, that the young people don't necessarily see the world the way that some of the older people do.
Is it too easy to divide that up into pre-crash and post-crash?
I don't think so. I think that's actually a pretty good way to divide it up. The people who have been in finance for many years, they came of age during a time when Wall Street was really not altogether accountable. I mean, it was a far different financial industry than it is now. And I think what you're seeing now is that young people aren't as enamored of the Wall Street culture because they aren't reaping the benefits of it. For a lot of them, they're sort of ashamed to say that they work on Wall Street.
And so as the 2 years started to wind down, and I should remind the audience that you were meeting with them in bars and in their apartments and in these really informal places, basically wherever they could, and sort of flying under the radar. But as you got, you know, closer to the end of this second year, what were they thinking? I mean, everybody, that second year was such a big, you know, you're either in or you're out kind of moment. Were they all kind of going toward in the same direction using the same thought processes, or were we really talking about eight individual decisions being made here?
I think it was absolutely eight individual decisions. I think some people, you know, decided that they wanted to do this for the rest of their lives. Some people decided that they definitely did not want to do it. And a few people had the decision sort of made for them, either by not getting offers back or actually in one case by being laid off. So I think there's a real sort of, these are real individuals who all went through their own soul-searching process about whether finance and investment banking was something that they could see themselves doing into the future.
And there were eight sort of different outcomes. Samson, for example, the guy we talked about before, he wound up going off and doing that startup and making that big leap. And he was he was the guy who, I think, who had the countdown clock in his room, right?
Yeah, he had a clock in his room that told him the number of days until he got his bonus. And at that point, he was going to quit.
And Derek from Waupaca, he wound up staying on Wall Street.
He stayed, and that was, you know, the most surprising thing to me is that that some of the, it was sort of hard to predict who would stay and who wouldn't. And so I think in his case, he was conflicted about Wall Street, but he ended up deciding that, you know what, I'm going to spend at least a few more years here, and I like making this kind of money, and I think ultimately it's going to be good for my career.
We've got to go in about 30 seconds or so, but you say at the end of your book, for the first time in decades, the big banks are beginning to lose their grip, and that's good for all of us.
I think so. We're seeing now that Wall Street doesn't have the same allure among young people that it did even 5 years ago, and I think that's probably a good thing for the rest of the economy.
Well, Kevin, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
We've been talking with Kevin Roos. He is the author of the book we've been talking about, Young Money, about the life of young people on Wall Street.